And we're back on Fictional Frontiers. I'm your host, Sohei Bawan. Each week here on Fictional Frontiers, we try to cover the best in pop culture entertainment, whether it's film, television, video games, just genre culture as a whole. That's what we try to discuss here. And I wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about nostalgia. Nostalgia in the context of what we're seeing in pop culture still, whether it's film or television. And in particular, I want to talk about the 80s, because if you look at the box office totals this week, Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire, this is what Deadline's headline says, Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire propels franchise past $1 billion as sequel opens to $45 million. Now, that also included preview screenings as well. It's the second best start ever for a Ghostbusters movie after the 2016, I guess you could call it a female iteration or a female-led iteration of that particular project. It says here, the domestic opening of the fifth movie takes the entire Ghostbusters franchise past $1 billion. That is pretty impressive, actually. The second film, or the film that was number two for the week, was Kung Fu Panda 4. Again, another sequel. A movie not in the 80s, but a sequel. So there's definitely some connective tissue there. And then obviously Dune Part 2 is there as well. And definitely a connection to the 80s there, even though the books which inspired the films came out decades before. There's definitely a connection to the 80s because of Lynch's attempt at the franchise, or taking a stab at the film version of the franchise, I should say. So what is this about the 80s, and what is this about nostalgia in general? Well, there have been different studies done about why certain projects resonate, why certain projects are made, and why certain projects are not made. And there is a lot of data and there is a lot of evidence to suggest that one of the reasons why we see so many nostalgia-inspired films, particularly those from the 80s, is because the people who are in positions of authority and in decision-making positions, they were children of the 80s. They're now in their 40s, late 40s, 50s, and 60s. And the executives in Hollywood, the executives in all of these pop culture industries are children from that era, and they long for the time that they had during the 80s, a time of innocence when they were either in high school or in college. And so if they're given the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, rather than produce something that's going to be inspired by or based on or tied to something from, I don't know, 2010, 2020, they're going to go back to the times that they had the fondest memories of, I guess you could say, responsibility-less adventures. You know, there was no responsibility, no accountability for many people when they were in high school and college in relation to, in counter distinction to what, you know, what happens when you get married, have a job or need a job, or have to pay bills on your own. And I think there's a lot to that. I really do believe there's a lot to that. One would then ask the question, why is it that the films are still successful, though? Because if a film is targeting a particular demographic or an age group or what have you, you're going to get those people on board, but how are you going to get the other people on board? And I've heard this before from Star Wars fans in particular, those people who love the Star Wars franchise or grew up with, you know, on it, 70s and 80s parents, or parents who grew up in the 70s and 80s, they say that they introduce their kids to what they enjoy. They kind of relive their childhood through their kids. And that's also the case with many people I know personally, including myself, I actually introduced my son to those things that I enjoyed. So it's kind of passed on from generation to generation. And since they grew up in the 80s and that was the time that they had the most quote unquote fun without responsibility, they have fond memories of all that. They still enjoy content that's based on that. They introduce their kids to that. And so those kids become fans of their own based on the iteration that's released now, but they're introduced to that content because of this road back to nostalgia, basically. Nostalgia driving executive decisions at the highest levels, okay? Because again, if we take the road back, we see that number one, Hollywood executives, and people in the pop culture spaces, they were in their teens or in college during the 80s. Now they've moved up the ladder to major, major posts and executive producing leads. And so when they have the chance to do something, there's number one, this natural affinity for content that came from the time that they had the most fun in. You know, there's fond memories from that. But then they also want to introduce to their kids, their nieces, their nephews, the young people of today, what was cool back then. You know, there's almost like a validation, if you will, of their backgrounds and their upbringing, right? Hey, I was hip, I was cool. And so I do think a lot of that has to be considered when you're looking at the success of films or franchises like Ghostbusters. And I was just reading the headlines this week and I saw that they're remaking The Neverending Story, for example, which is a very niche film in the sense that it was, you know, it was a film that had one scene that was very traumatic for kids. I always joke about that, where the lead character, one of the lead characters' horses dies in a swamp. Many children were traumatized by that scene. But the film itself was not a phenomenon. I think the song itself, the Neverending Story lead song, was a top 10 hit. But other than that, it wasn't something that people made a beeline to or towards as the defining franchise or story of that time period. And yet, they're remaking that film. And even more strong an example, or stronger, I guess you could say, callback, if you will, that really illustrates this, is the new movie from Tim Burton that's due later on this year, Beetlejuice Beetlejuice, which is based on the first Beetlejuice film. You know, Michael Keaton, who still to this day is probably one of the most underrated actors. There's something about his personality that's just not, it's not something you can replicate easily. You know, there's certain actors, certain talents that just have this this thing, this aura, this mystique. I don't even call it mystique, because mystique leads one to believe about or feel that there's something supernatural about that person. You know, they're literally in awe of that person. When in this context, what I'm talking about is that there's something uniquely interesting about Michael Keaton. He is a very good actor. He's been nominated for an Academy Award, and at some point he probably will win one. And even in the failed Flash film from last year, he was the strongest part of that film when he again played Batman, the Batman from the 80s. Again, we're going back to the 80s, right? So all of those warm, fuzzy feelings come into play. These, if you want to call it selfish motivations of these executives, also come into play. But the reality of the situation is that if there was not substance there, if there was not something that had merit, these stories would not be revisited, right? People would not go back and mine that again. And I would submit that there is truth to the theory that's been bandied about for quite some time, that a lot of these films, a lot of these projects from the 80s were more creative. There were bigger risk taken. There was more original content because the stakes in Hollywood were not as high. Yes, obviously they were trying to make money. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, there was merchandising associated with Star Wars and even before that, Planet of the Apes. And then you know, saw some other things in some other franchises down the road. You saw, you know, Batman actually do a lot of the heavy lifting there. But now transmedia, which is a wonderful approach to storytelling because it's embracing all these different mediums, is really, really at the forefront of a lot of the, excuse me, I had this lingering cough for a while, but we'll get through it. But the reality is that transmedia is so appealing, is appealing in the business sense because of the commercial opportunities there, that you can take a single story and you can make money in a variety of different ways, not just one way. I mean, that's kind of the bare bones, simple way to look at transmedia. Yes, from a fan or consumer perspective, audience perspective, there's a lot there that is appealing about transmedia because you're like, okay, I like the film, now I can play the game. Or I like the game, now I can watch the show. Or I can build this model. Or I can do a whole slew of things. But the reality of the situation is this, is that in Hollywood and in all the entertainment spaces, now more than ever, money is the driver. How much money can be made? And that's why transmedia really took off in a lot of different ways, because it wasn't just about having the movie. It was about having the merchandise, the merch associated with it. And that's still the case today. That is still the case today. In the 80s, and I'm not saying that they were not concerned about that, but there were not as many opportunities for merchandise. Just the other day, I saw that there's a whole line of reaction figures based on the Goonies characters. Now, the Goonies was a, you know, C movie, probably at the best. You know, a diversion. A lot of movies back in the day, they weren't the end-all, be-all. Now, every movie is supposed to be an event. Every movie has this added pressure to be something special. Back in the day, you were going to the movies to just have something to do on the weekend. And then you would move on to something else. And maybe if you really liked the movie, you'd buy the videotape or you'd watch it on cable. And then it would play again and again and again on cable. And you were so excited that, okay, finally I'm going to be able to see this movie again and again and again. But most of the time, franchises and studios and networks were not really looking at all the different possibilities that could emerge from one story. And then on top of all that, the budgets for a lot of these projects were not what they are now. So they took a lot more risks. They took chances. I mean, if I go through the laundry list of franchises from the 80s, there was a lot of original, fascinating content. You had Terminator. You had Tron. You had, obviously, Ghostbusters. You had Dragon Slayer. You had the Star Trek films. You had E.T. Goonies, which I said wasn't a great film, but nonetheless, it was a film from the 80s. Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Indiana Jones franchise. So many tentpole seminal projects, the Predator films, the list goes on and on. They're still being adapted. There are iterations and versions of those stories based on the original content. Obviously, Star Wars content. Obviously, Star Wars is at the forefront of all that. To this day, why is that the case? And again, I mentioned earlier, it's about nostalgia, but it's really also because those creatives took chances. A little movie like The Explorers, about these kids who build their own spacecraft and visit these aliens, was a fascinating movie. The last third of the movie was very strange, but nonetheless, you would never see a film like that probably today get greenlit, much less pushed by a major studio. Why? Because there's really not that much transmedia potential there. But back in the day, when it wasn't as easy to get merchandise out there, and you have to remember, when I'm talking about getting merchandise out there, I'm talking about not just the production, but I'm also talking about the distribution. There was no online way to get the content to consumers. There was no Amazon, and there were no websites where you could just click and order something from all these different places. There were not these sites that would actually easily create content like apparel, even for individual artists themselves. All this stuff has now become pretty ubiquitous, to be honest with you. Back in the day, it was not a level playing field. And so very few franchises had the opportunity to be a tentpole franchise or a series of whatever. And so, you know, there was a particular amount of money allocated to certain stories, and then the creatives would go in whatever direction they wanted, and they would see what would stick and what wouldn't stick. And if they got lucky, quote unquote, they would make another film. There would be a sequel, like Ghostbusters. There was Ghostbusters 1 and there was Ghostbusters 2. Back to the Future, another franchise, again, another 80s franchise. But look at Back to the Future. This day, even films that touch on time travel always reference Back to the Future, because the writers themselves were not just coming from a place of bottom line return based on how many toys you could sell. They were actually trying to bring something mind-blowing or thought provocative to the mass, to the masses, to mass culture, to pop culture. And so that's why those franchises even now stand the test of time. Unfortunately, most of the projects that have been made in the States as of late, I can't think of one quote-unquote franchise that I thought was, you know, extremely fascinating on many levels. I mean, you can make the argument that the Hunger Games had a lot of interesting elements to it, this dystopian way of looking at the world, which kind of set the pace for so many other stories. So that might have been something that was fresh and new. We're still seeing sequels to that franchise, so maybe that's one. But this fear of taking risks, because there's so much money being spent at the early stages. If you don't hit it or nail it the first time, you're in a lot of trouble. Pacific Rim is a prime example of that. If you go back and watch Pacific Rim on YouTube, just the clips, not necessarily the film, but if you watch the clips, I'm telling you, it is one of the best made films from a technical perspective, from a cinematography perspective, visual effects perspective I have ever seen. It still stands up incredibly well. And that film was definitely an homage to the kaiju films from Japan, the mech films or TV series that have been around for a very, very long time and are still being developed and made in Japan. But it had Del Toro's unique spin on things. But it wasn't a project from the 80s. It wasn't nostalgia-based in the sense that it was just, you know, a remake or a reboot of something. It was a fresh intellectual property, a new intellectual property. And it did okay. It did well. I mean, obviously, had it been in the 80s, if you look at it in the context of the 80s films, it was a successful film, because Pacific Rim, the first film, spawned a second film, and it spawned a toy line. It spawned some merch. It spawned an animated series. Actually, I think 2 seasons of an animated series. So it did well in the context of what would be an 80s franchise. I mean, go back to the animated side of things. You got Thundercats and you've got Masters of the Universe that are still being developed and considered for other iterations, other versions. So what does that mean for us as an audience, and what does it mean for filmmakers moving ahead when you see these kinds of things happening again and again and again? This revisiting of old franchises and them doing well. Well, you have to remember one thing about Hollywood for the longest time, and if Hollywood and these industries are going to quote unquote survive in their present form, they're going to have to actually become more astute and fan-centric. and B, people who really love the stories versus those who are just trying to bank from those stories. Because from the executive's position and from the bean counter's position, it's all about bottom line. It's all spreadsheet analysis. You look at the numbers, you say, okay, look, this film made this much money. We can calculate and project. And now with AI, it's even easier where we're going to be going in the next year or two if these factors are taken into consideration. At a bare minimum, how much can we get back? So there's a reluctance to do something fresh and new because they don't want to spend a lot of money on something that might be a Pacific Rim because they're looking for the home runs, at least in the present model. That's going to have to change. That's going to have to change if we want to see new, interesting intellectual properties at a pop culture level. I'm not talking about at a Christopher Nolan level. Christopher Nolan is an exception to the rule. Now an Academy Award winning director. He won all those Oscars for Oppenheimer. You know, it's just like Peter Jackson. It was kind of his moment. And it was also, in my opinion, a franchise award for him. But Christopher Nolan's films are not commercially successful from a merchandising perspective. There's not a single one other than the Batman trilogy that screams merchandise, that screams transmedia. In my opinion, his best film is Interstellar. There's no Interstellar toy line. There's no Interstellar series of games. There's no Interstellar merch at all because it was never intended for that. But that's the exception to the rule. He is the exception because his films do so well. He's a brand unto itself. And when it comes to the bean counters, when it comes to the execs, they're like, okay, for the most part, a Christopher Nolan film is going to gross anywhere between $500 million to $1 billion, possibly. So we know that even though his films are very expensive, in addition to the prestige, not his film, but the prestige that's associated with working with Christopher Nolan, we're going to make a lot of money from this. So they're willing to take a chance there. But if you look at the way Hollywood is right now, if you look at the cinema industry as a whole, it's still the nostalgia-based films based on fresh, exciting intellectual properties that still have something to say. Look at Mad Max, another 80s film. Furiosa is coming out this year, another 80s film. But that film was, if you want to say, the precursor to The Hunger Games. It was a dystopian look at the future after nuclear war. Again, something that we had not seen much of before. Those are the types of stories we need to tell, but we have to see stories and we have to develop stories that are not just for science fiction fans or are so, I guess you could say, complicated or sophisticated in their approach that mainstream audiences are not going to enjoy them. You have to build something or develop something that's going to be embraced by everyone if you want something that's going to be successful in the pop culture sphere or space. Even in the 80s, you had to do that. You look at something like Tron. Tron is a very fascinating concept. It's a simple premise. You know, you get to see what's going on in the computer world. Let's say, what if the computer world itself was a world that existed that we just didn't know about? You know, these programs running around and all this portrayed by actors. From our perspective, they're just, you know, dots on a screen, but in their world, there's something else. So it's a very simple premise. And I'm telling you right now, there is a reason why Japan has cracked the code on this when it comes to manga and anime. And if you look at what's coming out of countries like Japan, like Korea, like Turkey, you are seeing that that model is very similar to the model of the 80s and that people are willing to take risks. They're willing to bank on a certain level of success, but they're not looking to just bank on those initial projects at the beginning and then cash out. Because that's another thing I want to mention before we head out. And I've gone on and on and on about this. I didn't mean for this to happen, but I think it's worth talking about this week. A lot of executives, they just green light these films because they know that, okay, there's a possibility of creating some really interesting art here, some stories that will be fresh and new and move the medium forward. but there's always going to be a possibility that it will be rejected and no one will like it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to also go out and find those stories. We have to find those people. And not only do we have to find those people, we have to give people an opportunity to be in these spaces that we typically would not allow in. Because once you're comfortable in your seat of authority, it's very easy to just kind of push buttons, click here, do this, and redo what you've done in the past. It's hard to actually go out and do something that requires some heavy lifting, like finding the next diamonds in the proverbial rough, so to speak, across the world. There are incredible storytellers. Incredible storytellers. They just need the stage to shine. And so if Hollywood is going to be honest and true to itself and survive and thrive, because that model of making all this money is just not going to be there. The reboot nostalgia will eventually pass. You have to remember those executives are going to be getting older. New executives are going to be coming in, and maybe you'll go with 90s franchises instead. And so maybe you'll have some of those. But what Hollywood and what the gaming industry and all these television industries have to accept is that they're not going to make necessarily that much money like they did in the past, because too much content, too many competitors, too many alternatives out there. So you have to curb your expectations. That's what you have to do. And if you're willing to do that, then you might be also willing to explore what could be even more sincerely, which is to try to find the best stories wherever they come from, right? And manga and anime do well because they're not necessarily just Japanese stories. They come from Japan, but they deal with fresh, interesting concepts like Tron. And people who are so tired of the same thing again and again, are like, you know what? This is something I haven't seen before. This is something I haven't pondered about. Let me give it a shot. Let's see what it's like. And those unique sensibilities are what will lead to the long-term survival and success of these pop culture entertainment franchises. If they continue along this road, eventually you're going to see the bubble burst, if not simply be reduced in size. And maybe the people at the top just don't care, because they're just looking to cash out. So they want to make as much as they can now before that ship sinks. You know, they think it's the Titanic, and they're just grabbing as much money as they can to get in those lifeboats. And what does that mean? Just green light things now, make as much now, put a lot of money in the budget to say, okay, this executive producer makes this much money for this project, and then I'm not going to try to grow these stories any further. But I am of the bent and perspective that we need to expand our horizons, and there's a way to have your cake and eat it too. You can still have success. You just have to reduce the expectations on what that means and open your mind to the possibilities. You're listening to Fictional Frontiers. We'll catch you next week.